Because if you guys remember when we went into lockdown the first time.
Oh, yeah.
When people actually did it, right? Do you remember all the reports about how much improvement in air quality, local mm-hmm. air quality, everybody got immediately, like in yep. days, right?
Because dolphins just reappeared in the Venice canals.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Scotch.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 331 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm watching a waveform.
I'm Sam, and I'm wondering if that's a prime number? 331?
It feels like
it's one of those trick ones, though, because it's probably sure. by 7 or something.
Yeah. It's one of those sneaky primes.
11. I learned, actually, on that note, I can't
wait. Hold on.
I'm not going to profane. I'm not going to
Okay, good.
I learned recently that there's some trick with multiplying 11s that blew my mind. Unfortunately, now I think I can't remember it off of hand. But it's something really bizarre. Like, you can multiply almost any number by 11, and the numbers that you end up with are like just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 or something like that. It's like 11 or 9. But there's some bizarre thing like that that's really
cool. Oh, yeah, because it's cool. As you go up until you hit the double digits, right? Then you just double.
Yeah, because like, you know, like 11 times I can't remember. 11 times 11 is 121, right?
Yeah. So what you do is you go.
You keep going to this like 1, 2, 3, 2, 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, mm-hmm. 3, 2, 1. Mm-hmm. It's weird.
Have you heard of the? Hold on, I'm gonna remember my intro.
Do the rest of the intro. Yeah.
All right. Now today is September 30th, 2021. There's going to be profanity on this show. Not yet. But now from this point forward, there's going to be a lot of it. Yep. And also, we'd like to thank our recurring supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. Now, have you guys heard of the 3N plus 1 or 3X plus 1 sequence?
No.
This is apparently something that is baffling mathematicians forever because it seems so stupid, but nobody can prove it. Okay. And the theory is that if you take any positive integer, okay, mm-hmm. and use the following rules to create a sequence. Okay. Mm-hmm. If your number is odd, then you multiply it by 3 and add 1. Okay. 3n sure. plus 1. Yep. If it's even, you divide it by 2. Mm-hmm. If you do this sequence, you will always end up with 4, 2, 1 at the end. And then it's done.
Yeah, so it always terminates.
It always terminates. Always. And it always terminates at 4, 2, 1, no matter where you start. And also, it creates an incredibly unpredictable, wild thing. Like sometimes maybe you'll be at like 11 or something, and it only goes up to like, you know, 20 something, and then it goes back down to 4, 2, 1. And then you go to like the
sequence.
And then you go like the next number, and then it goes like all the way up to like it's 1800. Mm-hmm. And then it like plummets back down to 4, 2, 1 eventually, right? Fucking weird. And apparently mathematicians like both – they're all fascinated by it, but none of them want to admit it. And they're like, don't spend your career working on this thing because it's a career ender because it's fucked up. The sequence will end you.
Okay. If legends hold true, all you need to do is assign this as a piece of homework in some PhD level class and don't tell people it's impossible.
Yeah, and so people have brute forced it up to the like quintillions, and it has always terminated in 4, 2, 1. But then they're like, has it been proven
that it's unprovable? Because there are some things you can prove are neither provable nor disprovable.
As in, nobody like, can prove that it's unprovable, sure. and okay. nobody can prove it either. So far, it's pretty cool. But anyways, so we got an interesting episode today. We're going to talk about some – we've answered a lot of questions in the past few episodes. We've got some stuff.
Is a lot the correct qualifier there?
I mean, that's all we did. We've talked for a long time about things that people asked us. And we've answered very few questions about that.
So, at least three.
Well, let's not get – maybe two. I don't know. So we got a few things to chat about, just some life stuff today. And then if we get time, then we'll hit some questions. So I want to talk about one of my gaming accomplishments over the past couple of weeks. Okay. So because this is a video game thing, I need to establish some context. So I'll keep it high level. Just hear me out. Okay.
What you all got? Right.
So World of Warcraft has dungeons. It's a 5-man group content. Okay. So you go in with 3 damage dealers, people who kill stuff, a healer who keeps people alive, and a tank who basically tries to get all the monsters to hit them And the tank is like real tough, right? Mm-hmm. So that the monsters don't go like beat the crap out of your, you know, little wizards and stuff like that. In WoW, they've got this thing called Mythic Plus Dungeons where you can level up the dungeon basically and make it harder and harder and harder. Okay. So the dungeon has a level and there's all kinds of like achievements and stuff that come with doing super, super high level dungeons. Okay. And I've never quite enjoyed doing these dungeons because they felt kind of disproportionately difficult and not very rewarding for how hard they were. And I normally play as a healer, right? And so I would do them from time to time, but not really push it, okay? So I like the highest I would ever do is like a level 15. Just arbitrary number, doesn't mean anything to you, but that's just like the highest level I would do. So there was all these achievements that came out recently to do level 20s, which are dramatically harder than level 15 because, you know, it's like a
power
compounding power curve, right? So like if every one is like 8 or 10% harder than the last one, you know, then like five levels is like things are hitting very hard.
You can retire things off have that a lot, income.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Things have a lot more health and it's pretty tough. So a few of my buddies and I were like, let's try it, you know? And I'm thinking to myself, this is going to be a fucking nightmare because they're so hard at level 15. And when we did the 20s, it was super, super easy. Okay. So this kind of came down to, I finally understood that the 15s were hard for all the wrong reasons, which was that things in the dungeon would hit very, very hard, right? But just hard enough that people would live if they made a mistake. So people did not give a shit about making mistakes and they would just make it my problem as the healer to bring their health back up after they like stood in lava or stood in front of a giant sword that was about to cut their face off, you know? And that not, so I'm just like working super hard to keep these people alive because that's my job, right?
Right. Because there's an invisible sort of support role that's quietly cleaning up, or at least supposed to be quietly cleaning up mistakes, but it's being overwhelmed by the sheer amount of mistakes that are being
made. People don't view it actually as part of their job if they're not a healer
to prevent
right. damage from occurring.
Right. As a damage dealer, they're supposed to do as much damage as they can, full stop.
And just assume they're going to get healed in the process.
And if that means standing in a big exploding thing on the ground, just
so be it.
So you can keep doing damage, and so be it. So weirdly, once you get up to like level 18 or 19, those things that previously would take you down to 20% of your health just one-shot you, full stop.
Yeah.
So the damage dealers no longer can make mistakes, and they have to now start to understand all the different things that can kill them and then avoid those things. And my healing went down by half all of a sudden. Like the amount of healing that I had to do. And weirdly, I had to learn how to become a damage dealer as a healer because my role then became like, just keep people healthy enough.
Instead of getting healed, right?
Yeah. So just keep people healthy enough that they won't die to just general damage that's unavoidable, right? Mm-hmm. And instead, in between those times, I have to learn how to do shit tons of damage because all of the things that we're fighting have so much health now.
You need extra
that. It's actually – yeah, you need that. So it totally changed everything about the way that I had to think about playing the game. And also it was way, way easier. And we one-shot almost every single one of them, like just straight through.
So what would you say is the sort of the broader lesson that to pull
out? I think what's weird is that sometimes when you feel like you're doing something easier – like or something that should be easier, there's a like a mental state that comes into it that makes it harder, but for the wrong reasons, you know? Because like the content actually is easier at level 15 numbers wise.
Right.
Things don't hit you as hard, things die faster, you should be able to blow right through it. Right.
But strategically,
there's a complacency that comes in that actually makes everybody's lives way harder because people just don't care.
Yeah. Well, I think there's actually a whole bunch of interesting sort of metaphorical parallels but with other things, right? Because another one
you see this kind of behavior everywhere in life. Yeah,
but if you think about anything that's metrics driven, right? Because in this case, you're basically saying, oh, it's like – or the way that the game is designed is it says things get harder and because we make the numbers bigger, right?
Yep.
And
in the simplest way possible.
Yeah. And that's – but that's just like something like, you know, GDP, right? As like, oh, the economy is doing great because the GDP is bigger, right? But that's – but what does that mean? What is it actually measuring, right? Because if all it's measuring is just how – in the case of, you know, doing damage to you, how much damage it does is the only thing that it measures, right?
Yep.
But it's not like as a fraction of your health, so it's not proportional, then it doesn't actually mean the same thing. And so if you treat it as if it means the same thing and then act the same way you did previously because – right, you're just like, oh, it's just harder. I just have to like do better.
But that's the thing that I've been doing, yeah, but do it harder.
Just do it better, you know. And that's your takeaway instead of actually realizing that the shape of the thing is actually different now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because the movement of a number was an indicator not just that number had moved, but that the overlying strategy had to be different, right? And this is the problem that people suffer constantly with any metrics they ever use for anything, whether it's analytics trying to understand the world, whether it's KPIs that people are using in businesses or whatever, right? Is a metric is always a inaccurate proxy for the thing that you care about.
It's an opinion too.
Well, yeah, because why did you choose that metric and how are you interpreting it and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
And everybody overinterprets metrics constantly, right? And it's hard. It's just hard not to, because you actually like when you look at any metric, if you were to say all of the words required to actually explain what that metric does, it would be like a paragraph long and everybody would be like, oh, so like what can we know from this? And the answer is, well, exactly. Like not very much. Right. And so it's so easy to just like take a number and say this represents this thing and then to use that as a guide for your behavior, but without realizing that as the context around that number changes, what it means changes too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
And yeah. So, well, because as a healer, I always thought I'm a healer, right? So my job is to put out really big healing numbers.
Yeah.
And in the game, you can download all kinds of add-ons that show, you know, in real time, little charts and meters that show, you know, how much healing per second you're doing in a given fight. And like, there's just so many ways to kind of, like you said, create metrics and parse your data.
Mm-hmm.
And as we started pushing further and further into this harder content, I recognized like my job isn't to do a lot of healing,
studio. Yeah.
Yeah. My job is to make sure that we get through this dungeon under the timer.
Mm-hmm. The team's
with the
job
tools, is yeah, to with the tools that
win,
I have.
Right. Right? Yeah. And so you're part of a team. And so it's not just about – it's actually – it's basically the same problem we used to have on the art side too. It's like I used to just be pumping out art. And
you said my job is to produce as much art as possible because I'm the artist.
It's like a damage dealer, right? Being like, I'm just here to punch stuff.
And we've had this with our QA staff as well, right? Where they believe that their job is to find bugs, right? Which is a draft of the truth, right? but then they felt like if they didn't find bugs during some play session, that meant they did a bad job of QA, right? But that obviously isn't true if there weren't bugs to be found, right? Because that's not the right – that's not what they're actually – their job isn't to find bugs. Their job is to assure quality. Mm-hmm. It's to assure that no bugs get through to the downstream customer, right? Which is not the same thing as finding bugs. And so the only metric that they have access to though that's easy is did I submit – bug reports.
Right? Yeah. How many tickets did I create? How many did I replicate?
Yeah. And this is this whole thing with perverse incentives that we talk about a lot, right? Because like if you – anytime you tie any metric, some like simple idea that's measurable to something you want to have happen, then what people do is they optimize for the metric because that's what you've incentivized, right? And if they start optimizing for the metric, by definition – they are not doing the actual job that needs to get done because that metric is a bad approximation that doesn't change over time to match
in.
So it becomes worse over time, right?
In gaming, we call this padding. You're padding your numbers, right? So sometimes there'll be a boss fight and a bunch of little like ads, you know, additional like spawns come out that try to heal you. And as a player, you can like those things are going to get killed kind of just by like random damage the players are doing that flies out, right?
Because there's like explosions everywhere.
Yeah. So you don't need to focus on them basically.
You don't need to focus on them. But also you could pad by saying like my job is to put out big damage numbers. I'm going to explicitly set up my character to do a shitload of damage in a very short amount of time to just those things, like that group of trivial things, right? And yeah, you're definitely going – to suddenly launch ahead of everybody because you've just hit like 50 targets at a time for a ton of damage.
That doesn't mean you're the most useful person on the team.
But they were going to die anyway, right? So, yeah, we call this padding the meters.
Well, there's this other one from from art that I realized too, which is something I think about a lot. You know, we talk a lot about how many hotkeys I have and all the macros and stuff that I make inside of Clip Studio as I start seeing problems show up. And the biggest thing was the idea that it's more important to not make mistakes to go fast than it is to go fast to go fast. In other words, slow is smooth and smooth is fast is basically the idea, right? And so when I'm looking at how I'm doing on the art side now, it's actually not – it's not about output anymore. It's just about are there just sort of routine things that I'm doing where there's a high likelihood that there's sort of either maybe a misselection, a misuse of the tool, the hotkeys are like too close together and so I'm sort of mashing things up, or I'm just like always making the same mistake, because removing those mistakes, like these damage dealers, right, not standing in damage. The reality is like you're going to do more damage over the course of a whole fight if it's the case you're alive. But even if you don't, if the team wins, then you didn't need to be doing the damage anyways, which means you're being inefficient, right? You don't need to be trying to do the most damage if everybody's just dies because you're just Rambo thing, right?
Well, yeah, but it's also it is the team thing in the sense that if you aren't just getting hit by stuff anymore because you're avoiding those mistakes, then now your healer becomes a damage dealer, and because they don't have to stop and like spam heals on you to keep you healthy. So instead, now the team's damage goes up, right?
Yes.
So it's not about you now. It's about the team and what the team's goal is, which is to get through this thing in time.
Yeah.
And that's
that core idea here that moves into like relationships with other people, business, teams, you know, it's all this stuff, right? Is remembering that your own stats don't fucking matter, right? What matters is how good of a job you did to assist your whatever your group entity is, your partnership, your business, whatever, to get to the agreed upon goals, right? And that you did it in the most powerful way possible so that your absence or you having done something differently or whatever would have made you get there, you know, less powerfully, right? And then with it comes to this idea of these, because I think this is just really good because of the idea of support roles in general. And not even support, but this like idea of things being like cleaned up and fixed, right? So whether that's somebody fixing code, whether that's somebody tidying a house, whether that's somebody like dealing with minor grammar issues and all of the copy they receive from somebody who's doing work for them or whatever, right? Anytime that stuff is invisible or is just seen as like, oh, this person's job or this thing's job is just to take care of that, so that the upstream entity that's creating those issues doesn't feel their consequence or doesn't know that what they're feeling is the consequence, right? So, because if they're overwhelming a downstream person with work, the consequence they feel is not, oh no, like I've overwhelmed this person with work because I'm allowing too many errors to go through. They're just feeling, oh, it takes too long for me to get my work back from this person, right? They don't actually see that as like them being the cause. And usually it's not just one thing being the cause, right? But also the downstream person who either as part of their job or downstream entity, robot, whatever, right? Who either as part of its job is supposed to be like fixing these things and taking care of it, or just does because otherwise they look bad or create problems, right? And if that never moves back upstream in any way, then all that happens is that allows worse and worse work from upstream over time because things need to – like every entity needs to feel the consequences of its mistakes.
Well, I think just to this way, point.
Right? Like, well, the reality is the idea of like catastrophic versus graceful failure.
Yeah.
Right. But go ahead, Sam.
Yeah. Well, like the reality is like your team, whatever, can only function. You can only function at a certain level, even when you feel like you're giving maximum effort, if sort of tactically you have the wrong approach, if that makes sense. Right. It's like you couldn't get beyond, say, that like 15 level or whatever on this dungeon side if you, under that current paradigm, didn't like hadn't already like maxed out all the numbers based stuff to pad your body is like, because everyone's just doing something, essentially you're doing it in a harder way.
Yeah, you're doing it inefficiently.
Inefficiently, basically, right? But sometimes you really can't oftentimes tell that you're doing things inefficiently until you hit a hard cap where basically things switch from being like, we'll just kind of fuck you up a little bit when we hit you, to being like, you're dead now. Like, right? There's like a very clear feedback mechanism there that previously was sort of hidden. that make it so the whole tactic.
You usually have to get exposed to a different enough context that all of the mistakes that are being covered up and the inefficiencies that are being hidden because of the lack of visibility of aspects of the design, right? Mm-hmm. You end up needing a new context that's so different that those things create obvious visible failures. And that's the thing that allows you to, if you're thinking about it carefully, to like realize, oh shit, we need to redesign this. Unfortunately, I think probably what happens most of the time, again, in any kind
double
of
down.
Dynamic context, is you double down and now the accusations appear of like the person downstream doing
why can't this job. Healer? This healer should
have well, this is, why can't the healer heal better? And also the healer, that's the
stereotype.
Yeah, and they're doing it to themselves too, right? Because they're also being like, oh, I just need to get better. This is my bad that we couldn't do it, right?
This is actually why when I stopped
the reality that. Was they were being overwhelmed by the mistakes.
Everybody's mistakes. From
Honestly, this is why I stopped playing League, because I like playing support characters in League of Legends and MOBA. And in that one, so the support character always gets bound together with what's supposed to be your carry. So it's kind of the equivalent of like damage dealer, but on a whole, it's like one person who's supposed to be able to murder the entire team by the end of the game, right? Where if they do their job right and you protect them, they just become like sort of a rolling snowball, right, of power. But of course, I can't make people not do stupid shit. So mostly what I'm doing is you have these extremely aggressive players. Yeah, extremely aggressive, who you're trying to protect, but you can't because they're just doing, frankly, just dumb stuff extremely aggressively.
Well, because their whole thing is to behave as if they're gods, right? Like just
They're like, I'm Rambo. And I'm like, no. Like we are supposed to be Rambo together, you know?
Yeah. Whenever I play PvP games, I like to refer to this strategy as henchmaning. Because you're behaving like a henchman in a Bond movie where basically like your team just kind of like each person runs in one at a time and just kind of gets the shit kicked out of them.
Yep.
Because nobody wants to wait for the entire team to group up and get together so you can go in, right? Everybody's just like one at a time, just throw themselves into the enemy pile.
So I think the rough part is like what you see then at the – because I played ranked in League and got up to like the – I think it's the gold tier, which I think is like top 10% or something like that. And what you see is like, it's like Adam was saying, as far as doubling down, like even at that tier, you're still at the tier where that's still the mode where people are like, I am a carry. So everybody protects me and I just murder things. And if you can't protect me, like that's your fault. That you're not that's able to keep up with how cool I am and how aggressive I am. And it's like, and then what you actually see on like the platinum level of like people who are really, really good is that you have to get rid of that. At least enough of that ego on the carry person. Otherwise, the team can't do its job. Right.
You actually have to work as a team where failures are failures at the team level, right?
Not
and it's because there's
level.
A design problem somewhere in how the work is moving through all of the people involved. And so now the job is not to say like, why is somebody so bad at this, right? And because the real question is why have we optimized our strategy and design around what we have, around the tools that we have, right? Mm-hmm. Because
you know what?
There's no such thing as like an entity just literally – I mean, sure, somebody can be terrible at something like literally, right? But once things – like once people are doing the work and like doing stuff, they know what they're doing. They got a sense of the context, all that kind of stuff, right? Different people can then accomplish different things at different rates and so on within there. That's all true. But at that point, once somebody can do the thing, it's now the team has to come together, right? To design a strategy that works with where that person is at, right? You can't design a strategy that assumes that person is in a different place, right? That behaves as if that person is like the best, you know, 0.1% damage dealers in the world or whatever, right? If they're not that. So you can't just say, oh yeah, like your job is the healer, no matter what the context is and how skilled every single component of our team is always.
And if there's no – And if there's no healing to be done, even.
Yeah, if there's no healing to be done because
just heal. Yeah.
That's just your job, right? That doesn't make any sense because everybody involved is a person who's completely different than any other person. And the point of a team in all contexts is to say, hey, we're just people. Let's figure out where we're all at, right? And
well,
then
it's
design
to,
a strategy
to, that works.
To hit our goals that best utilizes where everybody's at, you know?
Yeah. But this is even, I mean, now that, okay, I feel like we're on the cusp of something here because when I was playing Rocket League quite a bit lately, and I saw this video by this Rocket League YouTuber, Wayton Pilkin, which I don't think is his name, but that's his YouTube name, called Why Platinum is the Worst Rank.
in Rocket League.
Is that the
so
top
platinum,
rank?
Or? Platinum is the exact middle.
Okay.
The exact middle rank.
That's confusing, given that it's called Platinum.
But. Yeah. Well, it used to be one of the upper ranks, but people kept getting better and better. And so they keep adding ranks to the top to keep it stratified, you know. But his explanation is essentially that Platinum players are good enough at the game and they understand most things about the mechanics of the game that they can do some pretty impressive mechanical stuff.
They're basically a really good solo. Right.
Right. They can like drive up the wall and like hit the ball off the wall and sometimes maybe like air dribble it into the goal, but only some of the time. You know, like they're not super consistent. Yeah. But they're very selfish as players, right? Mm-hmm. They want to score all of the goals. And so you have these players who all think that they are the best person on their team and the best person who's ever played, and that only their teammates are holding them back, but also they refuse to do anything to take themselves out of the spotlight, right?
Mm-hmm. It's so like they, Jamie so, Tart in
– Jamie Tart. I was thinking exactly the same thing, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So it's in Rocket League, they call it rotating, which is essentially that like you go and you go for your hit. And if you don't get your hit, then you got to kind of rotate back onto defense and let one of your teammates come in to offense. Right. So that you kind of like have somebody, a couple people forward and one person back essentially. But if everybody on your team refuses to go back, then your goal is always open and then you just get scored on all the time. Right. Yep. And so there must be some kind of a term for this or whatever, where essentially like people reach a certain level of competence at a skill, but there's a next tier of competence that actually is no longer about you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a broader right? it's about solving the broader problem than just your personal.
It's not even that it's no longer. I think it's that you can get away with making it about you.
Right. It never was about you.
Up to a certain point.
It's just that at a certain point you recognize that it never has been about you.
Well, actually, and you get this with so like there's the trope in the software world of a 10x programmer, right? Which is a person worth 10 other people is the idea, right? Because they're so good at writing code. But the reality of how that's experienced by like a company who like has such a person. And like there are people in any given discipline who are fucking amazing at producing, right? And who know a lot and who can do that kind of stuff, right? But the thing that they do though is they prevent the institution they're a part of from forming durable, long-lasting, really good teams, right? Mm-hmm. Because they do all of the work. They just do all of it. And if somebody else is trying to do it and it feels too slow, they do that work too, right? And nobody else is reviewing their work. And so a lot of it's not that good. These people tend to not believe that tests are important, you know, because
what's they about tests, output?
Right? It's all about output. And they know that they're good at it. So like, why waste time, right? Your job is to produce. And the inevitable result of bringing a person like this onto a team, which is why in modern day programming environments, the healthy ones, they actually actively avoid hiring these people. Because the end consequence is always that they end up with a fuckload of code very fast, right? And a lot of functionality. And then all of a sudden, everybody else starts quitting and all these bugs and fires start to appear and nobody can fix it or do anything about it except for that one person. Who's in that person's working constantly, right? Mm-hmm. But they're actually just creating more and more fires as time goes on.
And they're too busy to fix all the bugs that they have created because they're
possessive of the code because they made all of it. They feel like it's theirs, and you know, right? So you see this everywhere, and it's always true that in the short term, that kind of selfish level of like going for high skill and truly being high skilled and making it about you, right? In the short term, lots of context can work and can be like appear to be very powerful, but it's always a trap because once you hit the midterm and long term, you're toast now, and you often can't recover from that, right? What's sure as shit true is that you can't build a healthy team of people where somebody involved is making it about them. Mm-hmm. It's not possible, mm-hmm. And if you don't have a healthy team, you can't have a healthy long term structure, right?
I think something that's difficult about that though too is that. Because I think about like my own role as a programmer in our studio, because I have been the game programmer, you know, forever, and we haven't scaled up, and so in a weird way, like I've I feel that I've had to take on that mindset of like, I have to keep moving forward, keep producing, you know, the next game, keep working on the next thing. I think over the years I've learned more about quality code and writing tests for things and creating a lot of ways to, you know, verify that I'm not sending a trillion bugs downstream like I used to. But at the same time, there's a structural gap there, which is that because there isn't another game programmer that I'm working with, my code doesn't get reviewed in that way. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And so it's kind of like the idea of like the damage dealer standing in something, but then they just get healed up and they don't really notice that mm-hmm. a mistake happened. Right. Mm-hmm. So this is why pair programming is talked about as being such a valuable thing, right? Yep. Because both programmers have to be able to understand the thing that they're both working on, mm-hmm. which means they have to reconcile misunderstandings between the two of them before it gets committed to the code base.
And in the absence of that, there's also just having code review on every single change that goes out, right? Where
mm-hmm. yeah.
where nothing gets to go into production until at least one other person has looked at it and said, okay, yeah, just try.
I understand this. Yeah. Yeah. And of course, one of the challenges with a very small team, having the ability to do that is a bit tricky, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's also kind of like a no man's land of team size where mm-hmm. you recognize the importance of doing all these things, but structurally it's very difficult to create the systems that you need to try to make those things happen, you know,
yep.
Other than just saying like through sheer willpower, we're going to try to do as many code reviews as we can, which, you know, it still has to go
through discipline and structure, right? And it's always the same kind of a deal. Is some combination of those two, and which ones you have to rely on more than the other have to do with just everything else about your context. So yeah. So in our case, yeah. we don't have the option of having a structure that is pair programming or at least really constant pair programming versus mm-hmm. periodic.
Yeah.
And also code reviews are a problem too, because since we're each side in our own domains, we're all working on stuff. And people are trying to get stuff out, right? To like try things, get into QA or whatever, that adding that layer in the middle of being like, okay, well, somebody has to look at this, right? Means that somebody else now has to get like taken off of what they're doing in a timely enough fashion to go take a look so that thing can go through. But all these things are manageable by changes in approach and structure, right? Because there's things you could do with that where you can have like a separate track that's just for internals that you can keep on pushing changes to it yourself. And then collectively at some point they have to get reviewed before they go into QA's hands, for example, right? There's stuff you can do always.
Yeah.
Unless you're a team of one, then you're just toast, right? I think this is an important point though, which is that whether you're making it about you on purpose, right? Or whether mm-hmm. it's about you in practice, because there aren't other people to consider, right? Yeah. The outcome is basically the same, and it's
which is that a lot of mistakes don't get caught, and you don't know, and you're not necessarily going the pace that you could be going.
Yeah, well, and I think the biggest thing is it's always that long term thing, which is you because you're focused on producing, and there's not somebody else who you have to answer to in any way, shape, or form, then it's so easy to think that the only thing that matters is how much you're producing right now, right? And anytime that's the case, anytime that's your motivation, anytime that's your approach, you are always creating long-term problems, always. Just for the past 2 days, I've been working on trying to see how hard it would be to get our games working on a new platform, right? So to do that, there's two questions. One is, does our engine support it well? And the other one mm-hmm. is, how do we make our games work on it? Like, what are the differences? You know, what has to happen? Everything that's hard about it, about like doing that so far, just has to do with figuring out where all of the parts of the code are that are responsible for controlling
all the questions that you're trying to do.
Yeah, of like, what does it mean to be on a platform? Like, and what does it mean for two platforms to be different, practically speaking? Like, what does that mean we have to be considering? What checks do we need to do? Like, what do we need to enable or disable or whatever, right? That stuff is just like scattershot throughout the whole code base. And that's one of those things that like, you're looking at, you're like, all of it makes sense, all of it, right? And it's old, old code. But it's one of those things where you're just looking at, you're like, okay, this is one of those things where you're looking at the short-term production, which is just like, where you're not at all thinking about, okay, I'll need to add another platform someday, right? Mm-hmm. So how hard is that going to be when I approach it this way? And the answer is, very hard, right?
But this is also where it gets tricky, right? Because you can fall into a different kind of trap, which is the the one where you so thoroughly over-optimize for some other aspect of whatever the production is. That, say it's like platforms, for example, right? Because there's so much like just little stupid shit that goes into every single one of these, right? That you can easily fall into a trap of overemphasizing the importance of that, of speeding up that thing, when in reality, speeding up that thing means slowing down like everything else. Not necessarily just platforms, but like basically that idea, right? Where it's like strategically, you also have to be able to understand where, again, like try to make a guess or understand where on the meta level, as you're producing and what you're trying to ship, in this case, games, where it is that actually most of the speed needs to be, even if that produces a bit of slowness in other areas. And so we've talked about game design. Like,
it's about the nuance, right? Which is
you move the friction.
The problem is that people, they always swing one way or the other. And in an environment where either there's a selfish 10X or just doing whatever they want, or there's just one person. And in those environments, the thing that you can't help but move on the extreme side of is optimizing for now, right? As in, like, you're putting all your time is focused on, like, how do I as quickly as possible, like, get to the next milestone, the next, you know, feature set, whatever. And it is true that you don't want to, there's the idea of premature optimization, right? Which we think of it,
you gotta
but it's true for, it's true for anything. Mm-hmm. Which is, if there's a problem that doesn't yet exist, then it doesn't make sense to optimize for it, right?
Yes.
But if that thing is likely to exist, then you also want to make sure you're not making your life hard for no reason in this likely future, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and that's where the problem with the nuance, though, and the reason that the heuristics are what people go with, as in, like, either always focus on now always or always focus on the future, right? Is because trying to keep that aspect in mind while you're doing the work, where now you're constantly evaluating every new decision you make with that as part of the set of questions that you ask, is an incredibly difficult thing to train into yourself. It's extremely difficult. It's a disciplined thing. And like most people can't do it, even if they get really good at it, they can't do it consistently enough for it to always be the case, right?
Because no, there are certain things that
if you just like thought about it. Yeah, because if you thought about it, like there are a whole bunch of things if you just thought about it for a second, you're like, oh shit, yeah, this will definitely be a problem at some point.
Yes.
Right. And others where you think about it and you can see how it could be a problem, but also if you think about it a little more, you're like, but realistically, it's not likely.
Not worry about it.
So you cannot worry about it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to do that. And that's again where that second person can come in and be like, where they're doing the same thing that you're doing. It's just that now if you take two people who are
the fraction of the time.
Yeah. Well, it's the fraction of the time they realize a thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
If that's basically the same for the two people, but now that two people look at it, you're just now twice as likely to like to hit a more reasonable way of evaluating whether or not this thing is optimizing for the right thing, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
So, you know, lessons from video games. It's very, very important. All right, now, Sam, did you want to talk about Squid Game?
I just want to say I've been watching it. I think it's
a show.
Everyone's talking about it. It's on Netflix. It's a show. It is extremely bloody and violent. So if that's not your thing, it's very dark.
So wear a poncho, I guess, when you
– yeah, get ready for the splash. A lot of stabbing. A lot of very vicious stabbings. So just kind of prepare yourself for that. I think like 200 people just get shot in the first episode. And long story short, it's sort of like they collected a bunch of people who have so much debt that they basically couldn't possibly pay it off, more or less. And then it starts out by basically they kidnap them and then put them into these – it's like a Hunger Games sort of situation.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, it's Hunger Games.
Basically Hunger Games. and then there's – but that's like just the high-level premise. But if you win, then of course you win like this huge pot of money that would actually pay for whoever the person – like pay for probably all the debts, right? And so everybody wants to win, but also there's just a lot of murder. Like you literally – if you lose a game, you die. And so it's – but it's all these children's games from childhood that are then taken into this like extreme form. The first one being red light, green light, where basically it's where the person's like red light and then everyone has to stop and then you say green light and people run to try to get across a line of some sort. So if you are caught moving after they say red light, then you get shot and die, which is how like the first half of everybody dies. I'll spoil the first episode for you just to see if you want to even bother. It's very violent.
So legally speaking though, like I'm assuming this is in a universe where bankruptcy doesn't exist as a concept, but also if that's true, all these people who are being murdered in this game, will their debt just pass on to their beneficiaries?
It seems to be a combination of – so they said they did clear that up at one point. about how that would work, but also it's not just like regular debts. It's oftentimes like debts you're owed to, you know, like a street gang or something who will just kill. Like there's no bankruptcy provisions.
You're going to die either way.
So that one of the episodes is the most interesting is sort of like comparing their lives in the games to outside the games. And the basic point of the question in the basic premise of the show is essentially which one is the real hell in terms of, you know, how this is
probably the one where you're gonna get murdered immediately.
Oh yeah, no, I think I'm pretty firmly.
Or maybe both. They can, you know, it's not mutually exclusive. They could both suck.
Both be
in different ways.
So, anyways, I've been enjoying it, but it's very intense. So if you're not
sounds pretty dark.
It's extremely dark. If you're not into that sort of shit, do not participate.
I am curious. Like, I keep on seeing it pop up, and now with your explanation of it too, like it's hard to create a meaningful and nuanced higher level sort of like this idea of like which one's the real hell, right? When you take the thing to this extreme,
exactly. Yes.
The question is like can you do anything besides just create this like, you know,
this
murder spectacle basically? Yeah. Right? Yeah. And does the rest like once you start to try to add more to it, does it just like start to fall flat, you know, and become mm-hmm. absurd?
I think in order to make a lot of these points with me, it's kind of like animation, right? It's like if you just animate something like rotoscope, which is just tracing a person's body movements, it doesn't look very good. They hardly look like they're moving right, even though you're literally sort of copying it, you know, frame by frame. Just looks stiff and kind of whatever. And so you always have to sort of turn it into a hyperbole of whatever it actually is in order for it to read correctly mm-hmm. and have the spirit of the thing in it.
I think if you go too far, though, you know. Then,
well, now you're in cartoon land, right?
Squish cartoons. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that's why it's fun. That's why I'm
enjoying. It's always about finding that balance, right? And that is true because this is also, you know, like people say this a lot about sci-fi, right? Where what sci-fi does, and sci-fi and fantasy, is that they create a parallel world that like is reminiscent of ours, but is different enough that when you are one of the people causing the kinds of problems that the story describes, right? Because these books are always about like basically humanity's failings. But it's easier for you to not see yourself in it so that you can now – because it's just different enough. So that you don't even realize actually this is a commentary about the world that you live in and that you believe in and support, right, until it's already too late because you've like enjoyed or read the thing. And then at some point it clicks because you're like, oh shit, which is, you know, depending on the kind of person, like does this actually do anything useful? I don't know. But that's the idea there is that you can take stuff that you could tell people all day, you know, like talk about climate change, talk about vegetarianism, talk about poverty, they can talk about anything, right? And you can just tell people all day that the way they're approaching the thing is fucked up and horrible, right? And they'll fight you tooth and nail, right?
No matter how obvious
it is, right? Yeah, and then like in this alternate reality that like shows you what it would be like if we took that thing that is clearly true, like the thing that's happening, and just took it to its logical end, right? Or take a more extreme form of it to like get there faster or to exaggerate it, right? So that you can actually see like what is at the root of this thing, right?
Yeah, but I think just this point about the video game stuff from earlier, it's kind of the same thing, which is like a lot of things when you're not operating in the extremes, you can't quite see the contours of what's like the major
contours. There's a feedback problem.
Yeah.
I mean, and actually something that – so – speaking of climate change stuff and catastrophic failures. So there's that like a 1.3 degrees Celsius warming sort of critical point that's coming up, right? Like, oh, like 10, 15 years from now or whatever. It's like somewhere in that range, we're basically fucked, right? Mm-hmm. And we're just barreling towards this thing. No brakes. But when people talk about climate change and like your own personal impact on it, nobody really understands what that means for themselves, mm-hmm. right? Because it's like, okay, like what if I, you know, drive a bit less? What's the – like what is – for starters, what's my current impact on this? And like what would that make my impact be, right? So there's this this website that I went to. It's called REN, WREN. And they have a bunch of questions that you can answer about just like your lifestyle, right? Like rough geographic area, how much do you drive, you know, stuff like that. And then they have a carbon footprint estimate on there, right? And the thing that got me was, so for starters, it's like, yeah, you're below average for American households, like below, like my household is below average, which I was like, great, I'm proud, I'm so good. And then it said, if everyone in the world had your carbon footprint, we would hit 1.3 degrees Celsius warming in 3 years.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God. because there's like an inbuilt sort of carbon footprint to living in Western society that's very hard to work your way down from, even if it's just like just commuting to work.
So we've talked about, like, it's structurally, it's just like the difference that you as an individual make on the carbon footprint by doing these things is low. Like, it's not most, a lot of this stuff is, it's not that it's not worth doing, but a lot of the stuff is so structural and so big because it's happening with a bunch of specific, like, entities or industries or whatever else on a massive scale, that it makes it like, I just, it's hard to find a compelling reason as an individual, right, to do something to change until you put it into some of these terms where it's like, if every, like, you feel good about being a better American, right? But like,
but really, it turns out we're all real, real bad.
Yeah.
So being better than the average is still catastrophic, actually.
Yes. Yeah. Well, but I think the thing that's to consider though, when it comes to, because like global warming, yeah, like your impact on that and your ability to shape that with your individual daily actions, not very big, right? But importantly, what are those daily actions and what other consequences do they have, right? Because if you guys remember when we went into lockdown the first time.
Oh, yeah.
When people actually did it, right? Do you remember all the reports about how much improvement in air quality, local mm-hmm. air quality, everybody got immediately, like in yep. days, right?
Because dolphins just reappeared in the Venice canals.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, everything improved dramatically. I mean, and that was like an extreme form of this, but it still is true that if people are knocking down their, a lot of these different behaviors they have, it's not just global warming. I think this goes back to the whole KPI thing, right? If you're like, I need to do better to help with global warming. And then you now look at global warming and you're like, well, fuck, I can't actually meaningfully impact that, right? That part is true as an individual, which, so that's why we require collective action. We all have to do it, right? But all of the things that go to global warming also have local consequences that are bad. Mm. The more you drive, the more animals get killed on the road, right? The more people
get killed,
and then the more polluted that your air locally becomes, right? The more stuff you buy, the more trash that you just literally walk out and put out, like it's going into your local landfill, right? The things that you don't do, like if you don't, you know, cut your little slit your bags open and cut your rings on things or whatever, like the more like raccoons and things are going to get stuck in that shit in the landfill and just like starve to death, right? So there's like – that's the local consequences of these actions. And I think that it's actually one of the problems of how all of this shit is framed. It's always like, oh, well, like fix global warming by offsetting your carbon footprint, right? And then you look around you at everybody who just doesn't give a fuck, right? And they would gladly burn the earth into cinders to make money, right?
Well, not even that. I mean, you've got people I'm sure you've seen this thing that people do called rolling coal. Yes. Where they outfit their truck or their car with just really fucked up things that emit horrible toxic smoke.
Yeah.
And it's just like pure pitch black smoke.
Yeah.
And they do it for the sole purpose of trying to piss off environmentalists. So they just drive around just purposely pumping out.
So you have emissions tests, right? How do you do that?
Yeah, it depends on the state you're in, because some states you can kind of just do whatever you want.
Ugh. Yeah, but also they have it set up where it's like a thing that they can turn on to just like blast a bunch of toxic smoke around, right?
So you look around and you see this, right? Because and it's just the sheer absurdity and idiocy of people's take on like global warming and being like it's not happening or who cares, you know, those vibes, and the fact that they are the reason why we just can't fix this on the collective set right now, right? But that doesn't mean that your individual actions aren't worth doing, even if they have literally no impact on global warming, because
they do on the local spheres.
Because they do actually have local impacts, and some of them you can just see, you know, like literally every time I have like rings from something, from like, you know, cans of soda or whatever, when I look at it, I'm like in my brain, I'm imagining an animal getting its head stuck in it. Right. And so, cause that happens, right? Mm-hmm. Like it happens constantly. and like a plastic bag that's like easy to get into. I'm imagining something walking in and just dying because it can't figure out how to get back out. And I just like slit all those bags open, you know, and then just try to produce less trash because that's less stuff that is going to like, because we have like, we hear stories of, like, in St. Louis about the landfill here, like having it's had like an underground fire for 10 years or something, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Some crazy shit. And they can't put it out because it's some enormous underground smoldering thing, right? And
it's like, being constantly fed with new fumes, right?
And every time I throw another bag of trash out, like, it's okay, I'm just adding to this underground fire, right? And like literally just adding right to it. And so I do think there are plenty of ways to create personal incentives for all these kinds of actions. Like, same thing with like eating less meat, all this kind of stuff, right? Because like, yeah, one of the impacts is reduction in greenhouse gases and whatever, right? But your own impact on that is basically zero. But what you did actually do, if you stop eating chicken for a while, for example, right? There are literally now numbers of chickens that, like, living beings that you didn't eat, right? Like, countable beings.
Or right? Importantly, because the thing is, you know, farm chickens don't contribute to the natural ecosystem, right?
Yeah.
So like, by reducing your demand for consuming chickens, mm-hmm. right? Then that number fewer chickens need to be raised.
Well, yeah, right. And again, that's right. The collective impact, right? Is that part? Yeah. But that again, you as an individual, you barely get to impact that, right? But what you do impact though is that there are now literal, you know, beings that didn't die, not very many relative to like the sheer number, right?
But there kind of is though,
right?
It kind of is. I mean, if you especially
know it is. Yeah,
if you're in
the
U.S., like you're talking
surprising number.
Hundreds of animals a year, right? Yeah. Like, it's if you stop eating meat that now don't have to die just so you could have a tasty snack, you know, because you've got options. You're choosing to.
Yeah. And I think, and to me, this is
to
like,
kill those
this
animals.
Is kind of, this is kind of the bummer to me of like the fact of the requirement for collective action to work is that you can't have, you have people have to do it, and you can't have people actively opposing it who are with their numbers or with the access to the things, the tools they have to oppose it, can just block all of your progress, right? And the kind of collective thing that hits us all with is like, oh, well, I guess it just doesn't matter what we do because, mm-hmm. right? And because so much of the focus is on that stuff, it's a KPI problem again, right? It's like you can't meaningfully optimize your carbon footprint, but also who cares about your carbon footprint? Because like that's not a thing that matters. As you for individual action,
yeah, right? Your personal
it only matters for collective action.
Yeah, is
but an all infinitesimally things,
small percent of the.
But literally, all of the things that go into your carbon footprint have immediate, direct, local to you as well as to your local community consequences. Right. So if you focus on all of those things, the consequence for collective action is
a closer,
reduction
of global
warming. Yeah, yeah, and I don't know. I think that this the whole problem, like collective versus individual action thing, which we're all suffering from constantly with all these anti-vaxxers and all these global warming denialists and all this stuff, right? Is that they create this state of paralysis that so that even the collective group of people who are doing the right thing, that it doesn't matter, right? But it still matters though, like because people are so aggravated, all the anti-vaxxers who are making it so we can't get full herd immunity to COVID, right? Yeah, that's awful, and those people are awful for doing that. But that doesn't mean that you not getting the vaccine is a reasonable.
You
thing
personally,
to do, right? Yeah.
Well, yeah, yeah. Well, you personally getting or not getting the vaccine is not prolonging or stopping the pandemic.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and I think like this is like the societal version of like we're all running a +15 dungeon camp right now, yeah. right? And like it's really fucking hard.
Can't beat this.
Yeah.
One,
like you know, everything that we're doing is hard for all the wrong reasons. Because
nothing that is currently happening has to be this way.
Nothing has to be this way, but we're all just standing in the fire. We're all taking damage, making all of our mistakes somebody else's problem, right? And like at a certain point, we're going to be in a 20, right? Like our difficulty is leveling up, and the mistakes that we're making right now are quickly going to, you know, wipe the group.
Bet you didn't think we could loop that metaphor all the way back, but that's an episode long metaphor.
Here we right are.
That's we did place. It.
It's a good one to wrap up on, I think.
I think we'll cap it there. Good chat today, guys.
So, long story short, still take individual action and still push for collective action.
Weirdly,
let the
it's
failures
not about
of collective
you.
Action prevent you from taking individual action because it still matters. Maybe not in the way that you are like imagining all the worst case scenarios and like the collective consequences of the collective inaction, right? But it still matters locally. Still matters to you, right?
It matters a lot. To
the people around you. It matters a lot.
Do the right thing. Mm-hmm. All right. That's all the time we have for this week. We would like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Koster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, just go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to the Discord, a way for you to donate, and links to the podcast archives. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.